free material and turn things over to our official session moderator, Melissa Friedland. Melissa?
Okay, thank you, Jean. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Melissa Friedland, and I'm the National Superfund Program Manager for Redevelopment at EPA, and I want to thank all of you for joining us. The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI, hosts these webinars as part of a quarterly series about the reuse of Superfund sites. And SRI webinars share site reuse success stories and reuse challenges in the hopes that these stories will inspire you to consider reuse on other blighted properties. Our webinars also provide guidance, tools, and lessons learned to support the appropriate reuse of Superfund sites. And I think you're going to really enjoy our topic today. We're going to explore how the Superfund process can play a role in restoring and enhancing local ecosystems as a whole. And it's very exciting to think that ecological revitalization done as part of the Superfund process can also provide so many other significant environmental benefits. The TVA Kingston Fossil Plant Fly Ash site in Tennessee is a fantastic example of these benefits, and I'm delighted to have our presenters here today to share more about the site and ecological revitalization. And just before I move to my next slide, I want to tell you that the picture on our title slide is an aerial view of the site after cleanup, but more pics are on the way, so I'm sure we'll be able to see a lot more. Next one. So as we get started, I'll give you a brief introduction to reuse and SRI, and then I'll hand things over to Michelle Mahoney from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division to provide you with an overview of ecological revitalization, its benefits, and how it fits into the Superfund process. And after that, Craig Zeller from EPA's Region 4 and Michelle Cagley from the Tennessee Valley Authority will talk to us about the TVA Kingston Fossil Plant Fly Ash site and all the successes that they've had. Jean has mentioned this, but please feel free to ask questions of our presenters during the session. You can do so by typing your question into the question pod in the lower right corner of your screen. We will try to answer your questions after each section, but we may hold some questions if we think future presenters will address them. We may also have some time at the end of the presentation for remaining questions. And then to wrap up, I'll provide you with a few additional resources and points of contact, and we'll try to address any remaining questions as time permits. So let's get started. Great. So EPA's primary mission, of course, is to protect human health and the environment. And while EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, in recent years it's become a priority and an integral part of the agency's strategic plans and goals. And that's because returning contaminated sites to productive use can contribute to EPA's mission. EPA formed SRI to serve as a nationally coordinated effort to ensure that every Superfund site, EPA and its partners have an effective process and the necessary tools and information to make site reuse a viable option. So SRI works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. And there are a couple of important things to keep in mind when thinking about Superfund site reuse. And the first is that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. And second, there are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites. So there is no one-size-fits-all solution for communities or site stakeholders who are trying to determine which reuse type is best for their site. And in fact, many sites can support multiple types of reuse, such as the Milltown Reservoir, Clark Fork River site in Montana, which is in Region 8, EPA's Region 8, which is shown in the two photos here. And the site is home to a new state park, and it supports a variety of activities, including ecological, recreational, and agricultural use. Additionally, the site is a great example of ecological revitalization because cleanup and reuse activities restored the floodplain to a naturally functioning, self-sustaining river ecosystem. So this is just one of many, one of many excellent examples of site reuse, and I'd encourage you to visit the SRI website to find more in-depth examples. Sorry. The link to the SRI website is on the slide. and also listed in your resources pod. Now I'd like to turn things over to our first presenter, Michelle Mahoney. Thanks.
Okay.
So I'm going to just give an introduction to what ecological revitalization is, share with you a couple brief examples and where you can go for more resources and support. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the benefits associated with ecological revitalization. So the picture you see here is the cover of a document that we put out in 2009 that covers considerations for conducting ecological revitalization at contaminated properties, and the website here provides a link for this resources among many others. You'll also find other resources in the related URL pod, which is located to the right of the presentation screen underneath my picture. So you can find links to other information related to this topic and also the case studies that are going to be presented. But essentially, ecological revitalization transforms land from a contaminated state to one that supports a functioning and sustainable habitat. So some of the benefits of incorporating ecological revitalization into Superfund cleanup are on this slide. Some of those are reducing contaminant bioavailability, improving groundwater recharge, controlling landfill leachate, stabilizing soil, lowering costs, requiring less maintenance, and essentially leading to an ecological land reuse of the site. Timing is one key consideration. To maximize the ecological revitalization opportunities, cleanup managers and site stakeholders should begin revitalization planning as early as possible. And so the photo you see here is a picture of the Landia Chemical Company, which is in Lakeland, Florida. And this is a site where they replanted trees and plants on the site. And I'm going to talk a little bit about this one when I go over case studies. So ecological revitalization also provides a number of indirect benefits to communities, which are referred to as ecosystem services. And these are the life-sustaining products and benefits that people obtain from the natural environment. Some of those are listed here, just to name a few, clean air and water, providing timber, and also pollination of native and agricultural plants. There's also the benefit of using native plant species, and what this can provide at your site is you will have plants that don't require fertilizers, don't require the use of pesticides, might require less water than using a turf grass, for example. Native plants can provide shelter and food for wildlife, are critical to a diverse number of pollinators. They can reduce air pollution, provide biodiversity and stewardship of our natural heritage. Native plants can save money in the long term, and they can offer some economic values, such as easily accessible food, natural medicine, herbs, and landscaping. And in the two pictures here on the top is the fresh and saltwater wetlands that have been preserved and expanded as part of a cleanup at the Atlas Tax Superfund site in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. And below that is the revegetated cap on part of the California Gulch Superfund site in Leadville, Colorado. Ecological revitalization can also translate into dollars and cents for communities. And this can happen by improving and promoting nearby property values, creating tax revenues for communities through tourism. It can provide healthy lifestyles with more outdoor activities. It can provide flood control and stormwater management and improve local air and water quality. Some of the key considerations when conducting ecological revitalization at a site. We want to protect the human health and the environment as EPA's first priority. So when we're exploring ecological revitalization, we want to make sure that these efforts are in line with those cleanup requirements. Most ecological revitalization efforts are not considered enhancements and can be incorporated into the cleanup plans. And the cost can be justified if the revitalization is required because of the environmental stressors or adverse impacts caused by the cleanup. And you want to consider the interests, objectives, and priorities of all the stakeholders involved at the site. Successful ecological revitalization efforts are the result of well-facilitated and ongoing communication among all interested parties. Pictured here, you'll see where EPA works with local communities, federal, state, and tribal partners on a coordinated approach that linked remediation, restoration, and redevelopment at the Milltown Reservoir Sediment Superfund site. Some of the steps for planning and implementation, and this is all outlined in that document I mentioned on my first slide. You want to determine what your pre-disturbance conditions are as a reference that you can use in planning your ecological revitalization work. You also want to have a property inventory to provide a baseline ecological inventory of the biodiversity at the site. This can include the species composition and vegetative community structure, and you can use that as a guide in your planning efforts. In some cases, ecological revitalization can be self-sustaining and require little or no maintenance, after everything has gotten established. And what we've seen is operation and maintenance activities will be required, and they can include inspection, sampling and analysis, routine maintenance, small repairs, and any reporting as necessary. This is a table that is, again, provided in that document I presented on my first slide, and so if you want to look at it closer, you can go to that document. But it just identifies issues that may occur when waste is left in place on a site and discuss how these issues could affect ecological revitalization as well as potential approaches for mitigating these issues. So I'm going to just briefly talk about a couple of site examples. Today we have over 150 sites with ecological revitalization, and we do have a database of those sites, again, at that cluin.org ecotools webpage. Just going to give a quick glimpse, and then we're going to go into detail on the case study with our main presenters today. This is Palmer's and Zinc Pile, which is in Pennsylvania. This is a site where smelting operations in the late 1800s distributed heavy metals over a large area, including Blue Mountain. And this created damage of plant growth across a 3,000-acre area. So as part of this remedy and site revegetation, there was a customized blend of native seeds and site-specific soil amendments used. Part of the area that's been revegetated at the top of the mountain runs along a section of the Appalachian Trail. So EPA partnered with other organizations and planted 5,500 new trees on 70 acres of the mountainside at this site. There's also a nature center, which serves as an environmental education and recreational resource for the community. And these pictures on the left is before these revegetation efforts are taking place, and on the right is after. The California Gulch site, which is in Leadville, Colorado. This was an 18-square-mile area in the city of Leadville and the surrounding area, where in about 1857, prospectors and companies mined the area extensively for heavy metals. Mining operations left the mining byproducts on site, and these materials contained heavy metals that contaminated native soils and waterways. This is also a site where soil amendments were used for as part of the revegetation effort. You can see on the left the stream bank erosion before and then after, and what the site looks like today. And now this is the Arkansas River, which is now an award-winning gold medal trout water designated by the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission. The Vermont Asbestos Group site, which is in near Lowell, Vermont. This was an active asbestos mine from 1900 to about 1993. At this site, we did some preliminary tests of soil amendments, looking at gypsum, which contains calcium sulfate, and mixed it with limestone and some compost and manure and green matter and urban compost to try to see if we could revegetate this barren site, which, as you can see on the bottom left and the top, and even around the plots that were established on the right. And what we found is within 3 weeks, we could get vegetation to grow at this site, where nothing has grown since 1950. So this is a demonstration where with a site that does have potential for ecological revitalization efforts. As I mentioned earlier, the Landia Chemical Company in Florida is a site located in Lakeland, Florida. This was a historic fertilizer blending and industrial pesticide operation. The facility's waste management and disposal activities released contaminants into the environment. So the PRP group filled excavated areas of this former pesticide plant with crushed limestone to reduce the soil and groundwater acidity. They put a clay cover on top and to support the soil remedy and minimize any movement of the contaminants and provide a space for native plants and trees to thrive. So now the site is home to over 1,000 plants, including 30 varieties of grasses, sagebrush, maple trees, flash pines, and poplar trees. There's native seed mixes to provide a ground cover of wildflowers, grasses, and shrubs, many of which can grow in the shallow water and swamp-like conditions. And this project is also playing an important role in increasing the connectivity of the area's ecological corridors to provide vital habitat for migrating birds and pollinators. And just I want to say one thing about pollinators. As most people know, a pollinator is an insect or animal that moves pollen within or to another flower to fertilize the plant. And there's about 200,000 species of pollinators, and these include bees, butterflies, wasps, beetles, birds, and bats. And then one of the things with returning a site to ecological reuse can restore these valuable habitats for pollinators, providing pollen and nectar, native vegetation on the site to provide a space for the pollinators to thrive. So this is just one of the other added benefits of ecological land reuse. Here's a source of many more case studies and examples on our Clewin website. The web address is clewin.org/ecotools. You'll find information on other presentations on this topic, principles for land reuse, ecological land reuse, soil amendments, and much, much more. And here is my contact information. Please feel free to contact me if you would like any more information. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. I think that's a great background for what we're about to hear from our next two speakers. So I'd like to invite Craig Zeller to go ahead.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Waiting for my slide to come up here. My job here is, I guess this webinar is to kind of just give a little background on the actual TVA Kingston Ash Recovery Project. Just talk about the various pieces, the Superfund components of the restoration itself. It was about a 6-year job, probably among, if not the biggest, among them, one of the largest Superfund responses that we've done to date. And then just kind of set the table there for Michelle Tagley, who is environmental manager with TVA that I work with pretty much every day. Michelle is kind of in charge of all the various facets of that, and she's going to kind of get more into the details about all the ecological revitalization of various planting, et cetera, that took place. So let's get started here. A little bit about the TVA Kingston plant. It's in East Tennessee, just off Interstate I-40, about 30 miles west of Knoxville, kind of between Knoxville and Nashville, a little closer to Knoxville. It sits on the Emory River. Most of these steam plants have to be on a water source, of course, for cooling water. It's just above the about 2 miles above the Clinch River confluence. It was built in the early 50s. Initially, it was built primarily to power the war machine next door. The Department of Energy Oak Ridge Reservation, which is part of the Manhattan Project, sits just adjacent here, a couple miles away. And, of course, making atomic bombs requires a lot of energy. That's one of the original reasons why it was built. It is one of TVA's largest fossil plants in the system. It does have, when it was built, it is 9 coal-fired units. What you see here is really 3 generations of air pollution control concepts. These small little stacks you see on the right there were the original 9 coal-fired units that were built when the plant was put in. The 2 1,000-foot stacks were put in as a result of the initial Clean Air Act, and then that short little stubby stack you see in the back that has steam plume coming out of it. That's a sulfur dioxide scrubber that was put in just recently for SO2 emissions. Again, as I mentioned, it's one of the TVA's largest fossil plants in the system. It's about 675,000 homes a day in the Tennessee Valley. When it's operating at full speed, it burns about 14,000 tons a day of coal. Comes in on rail. Out of that 14,000 tons a day, we recover about 10% of that is recovered in coal ash, whether that be bottom ash or coal ash or fly ash, excuse me. This is a picture of Swan Pond Embayment. It's from the USGS Quad in 1941. This big kind of circular bowl here is the Swan Pond area. There's my arrow. Let me get that. This is the Swan Pond Embayment right here. This is where the coal ash disposal unit was initially sited. By current day standards, we wouldn't be able to site a coal ash landfill in a lake. That's not going to work anymore, of course. This was an unlined landfill, just to kind of give you an idea of what it looked like before. When the landfill was constructed, this is what it looked like, kind of pre-spill here. So all these mid-1950s, 1960s, probably even the 70s coal ash, or coal sensor plants, the air pollution control equipment they had comes out in wet. It's actually scrubbed wet, comes out of the towers in a slurry. And so TVA in this particular plant, like many of the coal ash, then would come out this little sluice trench. It would accumulate in this main ash collection basin or pond. And then they had a small little dredge that when they would pump stuff as it accumulated here up into these cells. So one, cell two, cell three. That's how most of these old wet fossil plants operate. So then it was what, 1 a.m. on December 22nd, 2008, we had a failure. Let me get to the next graphics here. So we had a breach in the impoundment structure, an earthen impoundment structure that was right about here. And we lost about 1 million cubic yards up here into this, what we call the North Embayment, or the Berkshire Slough. We lost about 750,000 cubic yards up here into this Swan Pond Slough, also called the East Embayment. Had about 1 million, 1.5 million cubic yards here right in this middle embayment. And then we had about 3 million cubic yards or more here in the main river, main channel of the Amory River. We had about a 30, right here where this arrow is, we had about a 30-foot wedge of ash that extended about a half mile up and about a half mile downriver. So we had about a 1 mile wedge of coal ash in the actual main river channel there. We were concerned about, of course, all that backing up, flooding back up here in the upper part of the watershed. And in the river is also a pretty flashy river, base flows about 1,000 CFS. We were worried about as the flow would come over that wedge of ash, it would scour that stuff and transport that ash further into the Clinch River as well as the Tennessee River and then make recovery via dredging or other means very difficult. So let me show you another picture here. This is a picture of the dredge cell that failed from a helicopter. I'll move my arrow here. This is the section of the dike right here, the relic of the dike that's failed. You see how it's kind of wrapped around. This is what we call the southern relic. This is the plateau of the old landfill that did not move. When this landfill, right before it failed, it was designed to have about 20 million cubic yards of ash in it. It lost about 5.4 million cubic yards of ash, so it was at about 25% what was lost into the river system. Just to give you an idea of perspective, which you might have to gain from this photo, the difference in elevation between where this arrow is and then this right here is about 60 feet. So there was a 60-foot cleave plane on that. It was very dangerous. What we basically had was liquefaction happen. I'll talk more about this here in the next slide. So as soon as this thing happened, there was a team of geotechnical experts from across the country kind of descended on this landfill to try to determine, you know, what was the cause of this. And so like many of these engineering disasters or catastrophes, whatever word you want to use there, you know, it's not just one thing, correct, that happens. It's usually kind of a combination, a perfect storm of three or four things. So when we use this slide in the public, we kind of described it as kind of the stacked too high, stacked too wet, stacked on a poor foundation. So just, you know, we had increased loads here on the top due to the higher fill. We were stacking a little bit too high. The fill geometry and setbacks were probably proper. It was wet ash, so again, stacked too high, stacked too wet. And then this bottom was stacked on a weak foundation. What all of these geotechnical cores found is that at the bottom of this landfill on top of the limestone base was a unusually weak layer of slime, a really, really fine coal ash. So when this thing decided to fail, it actually, the slip plane was below the water surface about 50, 60 feet. And once it started to move, coal ash, if you look at it in a microscope, looks like a very tiny BBs, right? And so this thing just started to roll like a bunch of little BBs or little marbles, and once it started to take off, it had enough liquid in it, it was basically liquefaction. We found, to give you an idea about the momentum behind this, we found coal ash traces as far up as about 6 miles upriver, up gradient, if you will. So not a lot of it, but it did get up that far. So it was a fair amount of momentum behind that thing. So once all the so-called dust settled, once all the emergency actions were taking place, we were in probably a 6 to 8 week period of triage out there, incident command systems where we had gas lines that had to be fixed, water lines that had to be fixed. We had to get the roads open, had to get, probably more importantly, if not the most important thing, we had to get the rail line back open so we could continue to burn coal, because this plant, again, is one of the heavy lifters in TVA system. It needed to continue to operate. Once that was done, all the immediate concerns were taking place. There was the whole, okay, what comes next? How are we going to, fix the situation? So there were numerous strategies that kind of kicked around. Ultimately, what we decided to do was put this thing under Superfund. The reason being is that Superfund was, we do have an experience, over, 35 years now of dealing with large cleanup projects that require years and millions, if not billions of dollars. We have a pretty refined and understood and robust ecological risk assessment process, as well as human health risk assessment process. We do have a community engagement, kind of protocol that is able to bring in multiple stakeholders to engage, and natural resource trustees, and everybody was going to be involved in this. But, from EPA perspective, it was a pretty good fit. We did enter into an agreement with TVA, then in May 12th of 2009, under administrative order. And it's all based under removal action authority. Okay, there was never a attempt. This is cleaned up under CERCLA, using CERCLA authority, but there was never any attempt to, or really desire to, put this thing on the NTL. So it was really focused on getting this work done. So we split it up into three phases, kind of short-term, mid-term, and long-term was kind of the goal. So the short-term stuff was a phase one with a time-critical removal action. We actually had an OSC, a good friend of mine, Leo Francidisi, was on site for about 18 months. That was a time-critical removal action. There was 3.5 million cubic yards of material was excavated and dredged from the river. That material was all separated on-site, dried on-site, and then put in trains. It was hauled to an approved landfill in Perry County, Alabama, known as the Arrowhead Landfill down in Perry County. So a bit about that, was getting over that hurdle was no small challenge. We didn't have room on site while this root cause analysis was going on. We didn't have the time to put it someplace else, or we didn't have the luxury. So this first material we had to take out had to go off-site. So I believe we had 27 companies that responded to TVA's request or proposal to take this material off-site. 25 of them were discarded immediately or eventually because they were trucking. options. Eventually two landfill options were selected or evaluated because they were rail lines the entire way. Ultimately, Perry County was selected. It's an approved landfill. It's CERCLA compliant. But the environmental justice hurdle on that was pretty substantial. Perry County is a minority county. I think what slipped out of that decision was that there was about $8 million in tipping fees that went to Perry County landfill and the Arrowhead folks. So there was a lot of money that actually was infused into that community as a result of this. So we basically sucked up all the mechanical and hydraulic dredging capabilities in the southeast United States for about an 18-month period. Of that 4 million tons that we shipped off, about two-thirds of that was probably hydraulically dredged with cutter dredges. About one-third of that was mechanically dredged. It was all, like I said, dried and put on train cars. It was 414 trains, 41,000 rail cars went down to that landfill over about an 18-month period. Now, that phase one work was done essentially at the end of 2010. So then we rolled into the midterm and long-term objectives. Phase two then I was pretty much in charge of, from the EPA side, of over phase two and phase three. Phase two was a non-term critical removal action. It was actually dealing with the material that was not in the river channel, but was back in these embayments and sloughs. A big part of this was the reconstruction of the dredge cell that failed. As I mentioned before, this dredge cell had kind of a bad foundation, so that thing had to be fixed to withstand these earthquake loads. So this landfill, probably the sexy part of this cleanup, if there was one, was the actual three-dimensional seismic modeling called FLAC, fast Lagrangian analysis on a continuum, that was actually used to make sure that when this 6.0 quake potentially strikes on the East Tennessee fault line or the 7.6 quake hits on the New Madrid fault line, this landfill was going to stay put. So in order to do that, we built the longest slurry wall ever constructed in the United States. Went around this thing. It was around 13 miles, a 4-foot wide trench was installed around this system, this landfill, to make sure it did not move under those earthquake loads. It was capped and covered, pretty much like with a river cap. It had a 40-mil liner, drainage layer, was 20 inches of fill, and then some clay on top of it, as well as the vegetation, and we'll talk more about that. So that was a fair amount of work involved there. And then the phase three was kind of the residual ash study. So when we decided to pull the dredges, all these super fun cleanups, at some point in time you got to decide when to stop dredging or when to stop digging. But we and my OSC colleague decided to pull the dredges. When we got down into the lower Emory River, one of our biggest problems was perhaps maybe not the ash, but the Department of Energy legacy material that was underneath that. DOE, because of their upgrade operations, had discharged quite a bit of mercury, PCBs, and cesium-137. Through some federal DOE records of decision issued much earlier than this, there was a fish advisory in place, of course, but also the DOE's Oak Ridge remedy for this was actually monitored natural attenuation or monitored natural recovery. So there was a big concern with our dredging work to make sure that as we dredged, we didn't pick up any radioactive stuff, put it on a rail car, send it to Alabama, only to have that rail car turn back around, kind of like the barge to nowhere. We didn't want to get in that situation. So by design, there was about 500,000 cubic yards of ash that was left out there. We did a two-year, $40 million study on that. Which was comprehensive ecological risk, comprehensive human health risk, and it was done under an engineering evaluation cost analysis, but it looked very much like an RIFS. So let me keep moving forward here and get to Michelle. This project was largely completed at the end of 2014. We were kind of waiting for grass to grow. in the first part of 15. We had our initial inspection, I guess, in January of 15. We had our final inspection in April of 15. In June of 15, we had kind of our formal project closeout ceremony. This is a picture from that. This was Franklin Hill. We've got a couple of these a year. My division director. This one was clearly earned by TVA. To say that they went above and beyond the requirements for AOC would probably be the understatement of the day. What TVA did for their community, as a result of this is quite remarkable. Initially, there was $43 million that was given by TVA to the local counties. There is known as Rome County, which is $14 million. It's called the Long-Term Economic Recovery Council. And so with that money, Rome County got several new elementary schools. There was a new wastewater treatment plant built for the city of Kingston, a historic theater in Harriman, known as the Princess Theater, was restored. A variety of community-based, projects were implemented and conducted with that money. There was $500,000 of surplus material from the construction site. From the construction work was donated to Rome County. $300,000 for repaving a Swan Pond Road. There was a $4 million bridge that was built. That was a huge improvement at Swan Pond Circle. That $4 million bridge was allowed us to keep construction traffic off local roads, but also improved the traffic flow in the area. And some of the stuff Michelle's going to get into, there was a 60-acre sports complex built. There was a 32-acre passive park built. And then, kind of the cherry on top of the sundae, if you will, one of the concerns we heard throughout our cleanup efforts out there and our community engagement was that people were paying a higher rate for home insurance because there wasn't a local volunteer fire department close by, no EMS service. So TVA did donate up to 10 acres to build a Rome County EMS system as well as a volunteer fire department. So there was, all those reasons kind of went in. That's kind of the layup of the day as far as why we decided to recognize and acknowledge TVA for their efforts in going above and beyond, not just cleaning up the Superfund site. I think the one thing I've learned, I've been doing this for 26 years, is, I always thought it was just getting the site cleaned up, right? Well, now it's not just getting the site cleaned up, but using, best management practices and the stuff we're talking about as far as some of the stuff we talk about as far as ecological revitalization and pollinator habitat, it does get us bonus points on our exam, right? Not just that we're cleaning up the site, but we're also getting bonus points. But as Melissa mentioned, some of this native vegetation is much easier to get established. You don't have to mow it. You don't got to water it. And it just makes, a lot of it is just, do we get green remediation points? Do we get ecological revitalization bonus points? Sure we do. But on the same token, isn't it just really, at the end of the day, just good project management decisions? I would say yes to that. So just, I think one more slide here, and I'll turn it over to Michelle, just an overview of the cost. It was about half and half. The phase one costs were just under $600 million. About half of that was spent on ash dredging and disposal down in Perry County. The other half was, for really the non-term critical fixing that landfill, the wall and stacking and et cetera. The initial budget on this thing was $1.178 billion. We came in about $44 million under that. So about 6 years, just under 6 years of work, and we're divided by about $1.13 billion. And that's my contact information. I will say if you liked yellow iron, if you like yellow iron, I do, this was the place for you. I think we had several hundred pieces of yellow iron on site at one point in time, 900 personnel, just to give you an idea of how many different people we had out there. The health and safety concerns are huge. We burned through just over 6.7 million man hours. So it was a big deal. Some other stats that I could, cite, I like numbers, but just one that jumps out to me, besides the 13 miles of 4-foot trench, we also had 86 miles of liner seam on that landfill that had to be 86 miles. It was, we tap landfills all the time, every day, you know, 24/7, but nothing quite like this one. This one, as far as numbers and size, it's kind of ruined me. So anyhow, that's kind of a project background. I'll turn that over to Michelle.
Okay, hold on. Right before we do that, thank you, Craig. I just want to take this opportunity. You've gotten a few questions, so I'm going to use the time to do that. And we did have a couple of people write in that they were having a little trouble hearing you. So if I could ask you to just be sure to speak a little slowly in your answer, I think that'll be really helpful. But thank you very much, yeah, for telling us that. And the first question is, who's responsible for the long-term monitoring of the site?
TVA is responsible. TVA paid for all of this. They not only paid for all the capital upfront costs, but they also paid for all our oversight and response costs, as well as TX for that matter. And they did reach an NRDA settlement with the trustees, which Michelle is going to talk about here in a moment. But as far as long-term monitoring, TVA is responsible for that.
Okay, great. We've got it. Yeah. I'm sorry.
And we're kind of doing an annual, we've backed into an annual monitoring program. We are doing policy five-year reviews here. This was a removal action, so of course we're not required to do statutory five-year reviews, but we did make a determination to just do policy. So we are continuing to do annual monitoring out there. Most of it is based on sediment concentrations. We're doing some counting some bugs. We have been doing some tree swallow work that I believe we're going to kind of scale back on. But it's a pretty typical monitoring program for a Superfund site. It would look like many others that I know folks on the line have seen. It's not much different.
Okay, thanks. Another question, Ed, with all that going on, did you have any fatalities or injuries, and did you have any fish kills?
Let me take the first one. We unfortunately, while the actual ash release itself did not cause any fatalities, we had some property damage, and of course we had a bunch of ash in the river, which wasn't a bad thing. But unfortunately, I believe it was in July of 2009, Michelle can correct me if I'm wrong on that, we did have one fatality. It was obviously hugely unfortunate. We were taking off some dredge pipe coming off of flatbed trucks, and the driver got out of the truck when he wasn't supposed to, and the load had shifted in transport, and the pipe shifted around, slipped up the truck, and happened to crush the guy. So that was awful. It was horrible. We had, I believe it was a two-week shutdown. So I often take the stand on that to make sure that didn't happen again. We had some other minor issues, of course, as you would when you have 900 people on site, 6.7 man hours. But for the last couple of years, I believe we went, no lost time on that. As far as fish kills, Michelle can talk more about that from the NRDA settlement. But our fish kill was mostly burial. It wasn't TSS, I can't breathe type of thing, or a toxic thing. It was basically they got buried by a tsunami of coal ash. That also would apply to the benthic community as well.
Okay, thanks. And one, I'm sorry. We
should answer the question there?
Sorry. There's one more question. Would you mind reading?
Okay.
Sure. We have a question from someone who they wanted to know about how the remedial action was justified under the Superfund regulatory framework, seeing that fly ash is not regulated under CERCLA?
Ha-ha. That's a very good question. That must come from a lawyer. I joke. That's a great question. Kingston was big as far as magnitude goes, not just because of the cleanup, but what it triggered. Right. When Kingston happened, it did trigger a national discussion about how coal ash should be regulated. EPA got in through our RCRA program at headquarters, started looking at rulemaking. Eventually, we did go we looked at a subtitle C reg, we looked at a subtitle D reg. The number of comments we got on that regulation, that proposed regulation, I think around 500,000. So it was a big deal. Eventually, I guess it was December 14th, EPA did come out with a subtitle D reg, and I think that's probably the right answer. So to treat, this coal ash as we do municipal solid waste, dispose of it in a lined landfill. I think that's a very good place for it. So early on, yeah, we've got to write a Superfund AOC right now, right? We've got to write a removal action AOC that gives us the authority to take action here. And that was difficult. What we did look at eventually was arsenic and selenium were the numbers that we used to trigger the action on this. And really what got our foot in the door on it was the arsenic concentrations. The average arsenic concentration of this was around 60 to 70 ppm. So again, not real high. The average background concentration for the East Tennessee soils is around 40 or 30, excuse me. So we were just above background. It's pretty much how we got into it, how we got Superfund authority carved out. And also, there was a lot of the inhalation pathway. I think most toxicologists, whether you work for the federal government or whether you work for private industry or whatever, will agree that the big risk, the real risk posed by coal ash is through the inhalation pathway. And we had a bunch of coal ash out there that was not vegetated, wasn't contained, and through that, dust or through that fugitive emission stuff, there could have been some sort of, respiratory impact. So it was really the actual metals concentration as well as the dust issue is how we kind of got in through Superfund.
Okay, great, Craig. Thank you very much. We can answer some more questions later. I'm going to turn it over to Michelle Cagley right now, and take it away, Michelle. Thanks. Michelle?
Okay, yeah, I'm here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how we moved through the process and had this restoration work in mind. As we began the process, as we were moving through cleanup, we knew that we had some obligation to the community and also a natural resource damage assessment obligation to do some ecological restoration. So we made plans before we got to the end of the cleanup to incorporate this restoration work. So when we looked at our restoration objectives, we wanted to protect and improve the wildlife habitat. Part of the area where the ash moved through the embayment was once forested islands or peninsulas. Some of the shoreline that was there had never been in really good condition for ecological improvements, because a lot of the area that we ended up working on had previously been a land or a farm, so it had not provided a lot of habitat. There was also an opportunity to protect wetlands that were already there and to enhance those. There were some that had existed on the farm prior to it being managed in a way to provide more pasture for cows and took away a lot of the wetland area. So we had an opportunity to restore that area back to a wetland after we were done doing the cleanup. We were looking to stabilize shoreline. A lot of this area had no vegetation once the cleanup was complete. Some of it had had it in the past, but it was disturbed as we moved through and did the cleanup operation. We were looking at minimizing erosion from areas where we had worked, and we wanted to provide recreation opportunities to the community. TVA had made a commitment early on to make the area as good or better than it had been before we had the spill. So if you look at the map of the restoration area, it shows a number of things that we put in place, and we tried to connect everything. So we have a wetlands area on the north side of the property. That area was where we had purchased a farm to provide the borrow material required to cover the cap that we put in place when the ash was back in the cell. So we had taken borrow off of that, and we allowed the area to return to a wetland. We have an area that has trailed all along the waterway. We put in fishing piers. We put in a couple of weirs to manage water levels. There are trails that lead to a park on Lakeshore, and it allows folks to cross all the way over from, you can walk if you want, all the way from these wetlands, all the way over, you cross the road and then continue and cross a bridge onto the property that has a park, and there's 2 miles of trails in the park itself. We provided opportunities for canoe launches, kayaks. There's a new boat ramp in the area, and it made it a very good place for the community to come. So when we looked at revegetation of the shoreline habitats, we used native plantings and all the revegetation efforts along the shoreline. We put in water control structures. So if I go back one, during cleanup, in order to facilitate the work, we had put in a weir to keep the water off of the excavation of the ash that had filled the embayment. As we got near the end, we saw an opportunity to leave that weir in place with an added control structure so that we could control the water level. In the winter, this area typically, when the lake went down, that all the area was exposed and was nothing but a big mud flat. So we put in a weir there and control the water level to keep it up in the winter to provide water here, and that helps with shorebirds. And then there's another weir under the walking trail to the north, and it stays and keeps the water level in the wetland continuous all year round, and that enhances the wetland plantings there so they aren't exposed with no water during the winter period like they were previously. We have tried to remove invasive species as much as we could in the areas we were working. This had been a residential area. The people over the years had planted things that were not native, and some of them were invasive. There were large amounts of privet on the property. We've dealt with a good deal of kudzu on the property that was covering everything else. There were some things that were hurting the wetland as well, so we took as many of those out and have managed some of them with herbicides along the way. We also looked to enhance the upland habitat, so we used the wildlife mix to provide forage for the local wildlife, deer, turkey, other birds in the area. And we also were looking at preserving the things that were already in place. So the wetlands that had been there previously, we wanted to have a way to manage that to make it better. And we enhanced aquatic habitat. So as we were working through the process, we saved trees. If we had to cut trees to do some work, we saved those and have used them as fish attractors and placed them out in the embayment to provide habitat for fish in areas that, because of the excavation, were nothing but bare ground. We had taken all the vegetation out along with the ash. And we created some new aquatic habitat by keeping the water up, and we put in some vernal pools. So the plantings that are there, and it's a little hard. We had a mixture of seed plantings along the way so that it matched the amount of water that was on the property. So as you move up and down in elevation on the lake shore, and depending on where you're at on the time of year, we chose plantings that would survive having either a lot of water on them or a little bit of water on them, or things that were upland. And they each had a use for the ecological community that comes in. And so we have some pictures of some of the things we put in. The wetlands are coming back. So they started out with very little vegetation on them because they had been bare. But as the water is left on it, we've seeded some of it, and then some of it has come back naturally. We have a large area of riparian zone plantings that were put in place, and they will grow up and have shading and shelter for birds. It will help cool the waterway and provide some shade and some protection from erosion. Fish attractors are in, and the fishermen found those before we were even complete with our work. We were trying to finish the work on the Lakeshore Peninsula Park, and we had the road blocked off, but people would park along the roadway and walk in to fish because the fish had already come into the area. We provided some bird attractors to allow nesting for osprey, who tried to nest on every piece of equipment we left up in the air overnight during their nesting period. And the vernal pools have come in, and that's to provide an area for amphibians to breed and grow, and they are filled with water. In addition to the ecological enhancements we put in place, we also knew that there was a need in the area for recreational enhancements. The Swan's Pond community really did not have a lot of things on this side of the river. There were things nearby in the city of Kingston, but nothing in the immediate area that was impacted by our cleanup operations. So TVA wanted to provide some opportunities specifically for the most impacted community. There's four miles of paved walking trails, and it's all ADA accessible, so it can be used by anyone. There are two courtesy docks and four fishing piers, which get used often. The pedestrian bridge gets used to be walked across, but very often you will see a fisherman who is fishing off the bridge, and apparently they do well. There's also a boat ramp there that provides access. The closest one was about 5 or 6 miles downriver, so now fishermen can launch and boaters can launch from there to recreate in this portion of the river. And there's a quite popular area just upstream, so it provides access there. TVA also put in restroom facilities, which were not available in this area on this part of the lake. There are picnic areas and informal overlooks. We planted nearly 7,000 trees as part of our restoration effort, and we revegetated and restored 5 miles of shoreline. And that has been used by the community quite often already, especially now that the spring has come. We see lots of people in the park. The picture shows some examples of the walking trails and the boat ramp and dock that were put in. The canoe launches, people have launched their canoes and kayaks, and on part of the Swan Pond embankment, you cannot take a motorized boat in, so the canoes and kayakers are the only ones that have access to that portion of the lake. And we provided plenty of parking for the area so that the community can come out and use it. And part of the stuff that we did not build out, but we provided to the community was was an area for the county to build ball fields for their future use. So TVA licensed a large portion of the area that was a former farm. So all through here is an area that was licensed for the community, the county, to use as a festival area, They have already, we put in, TVA went ahead and placed the sod for a soccer facility that should be able to be used this summer. And then TVA provided the land and brought it to grade for a softball and baseball facility that TVA provided the design for that the county will build at a future date. Along the way, TVA was in communication with the Fish and Wildlife Service and the state of Tennessee to ensure that plans would meet needs for natural resource damage assessment. We discussed needs of the county with the county commission. There was a public meeting held on the design of the recreation facility so we could gather input from the community on it. And most of these things, some of it went toward NRDA, but a lot of the things that were done were even beyond what was required. And having the property available from the Barrow area gave a safe place for us to provide these things for the community that was not on the operating plant property. I'm going to go back and skip to the end. So that's my contact information if you have questions. I guess one of the biggest lessons that TVA learned along the way was while you had the large equipment available and while we were doing grading work, to go ahead and have your plans laid out for the restoration work you wanted to do, and that is the most cost-effective way to move forward with your restoration efforts. So if you can go ahead and not have to mobilize a workforce, and while you're grading anyway to finish your cleanup operations, to have a plan for your restoration, it allows you to get the most bang for your buck with the cleanup and the restoration work going hand in hand. It also provided some contract ability to roll things in with the contracting so you don't have to piecemeal it after the fact.
Well, thank you, Michelle. That's great, and we really appreciate that telling us all those details. We have a couple of questions for you, and one of them is, what is a weir, and how do you spell it?
A weir is a water structure which allows you to set an elevation and hold it and then allow water to pass below that elevation. It's W-E-I-R.
Okay.
It's
always a danger when you let engineers talk at an eco conference.
And along those same lines, we have, can you give us a good definition of an embayment?
An embayment is an area where water backs up. So there are creeks that go through, and so you have a depression. So when you have the lake back up, it covers a secluded kind of a backwater portion. It's not part of a main channel.
Okay.
Backwater would be a good definition for it. Yep.
Okay, great. And then maybe this is for all of you. Someone's written in and said, what is the best path for entering a career in ecological revitalization? Is EPA the main employer for those kinds of things? So, if you want to give any advice.
Michelle might want to elaborate on that. I mean, that real nice architectural drawing that you had that had the mix of all the various vegetation, that was done by one of a contractor for. Jacobs did that for you, right, Michelle?
Yeah, Jacobs did it, and it's kind of a mix. So we were working with landscape architects who had a ecological bent, so it was really a team effort to, when you look at an ecological restoration, so you need biologists to kind of tell you what the needs are of the organisms in the area. You have landscape architects that know what plants can be put where and what elevations you have to make them successful, how much water they can tolerate. And then you have engineers that are designing some of the harder structures such as the weir and the dams and the bridges and the parking lots and pathways. So you end up with a team approach. So depending on what your interest is, you could come at it from a number of ways and feed into a career in ecological revitalization and restoration.
And this thing was, you know, like most of the stuff, it was a giant compromise because Michelle's, I think her point, her take-home point is spot on, is that on most of these Superfund sites, what makes the most sense from a cost-effective standpoint is run your cleanup concurrent with any NRDA work that may be required. Don't, you know, that's the most cost-effective way to knock it out. So, you know, historically over the last thousands of years, engineers just love rock and concrete. I'm an engineer. Michelle's an engineer. We love rock and concrete, riprap, because it's going to stay there forever. I don't have to monitor it. I'm not going to come back and mow it. I ain't got to worry about it, right? But now, you know, on the other side of the equation that Michelle was trying to solve as well is that your ecotypes, particularly your trustee types, they're not big fans of concrete. Right, they think concrete's stupid because it doesn't, you know, it has nothing to do with wildlife, it has no habitat considerations, et cetera. So in many cases, in order to satisfy those, as we were designing this stuff, we backed out of a lot of that hard. If you go to any Corps of Engineers lake, you know, you see a lot of riprap around the shoreline, et cetera, et cetera. That's changed, I think, over the last, particularly the last 5-10 years, that concept, that I hate the word, but paradigm, has changed. And in this case, we put up, Michelle, you might want to talk about that green wall that you guys use for shoreline stabilization.
Yeah,
that was pretty neat.
We built a vegetative wall where we used soil bags to build in layers, and then we planted it with willow stakes. So instead of having an area that's armored with riprap, we constructed a vegetative wall where the root structure of the plantings will hold the shoreline even when you have flows that come against it.
And let me just interrupt one second here. We had a question that came up, Michelle, and I'm going to throw it out to you, and then, Craig, I'll let you finish. Have you dealt with people who are worried about roots puncturing the cap?
So none of the plantings are on top of the cap of the landfill. It had different requirements than what we were able to do. Most of our restoration work was in the borrow area. So the cap has very specific plantings, what kind of height you can have, what kind of grass coverage you have to have. So none of this work was done on top of the cap landfill. It was done on the shoreline, and it was done in the borrow area that we brought the soil from.
Okay, and Craig, in your experiences in RPM, have you dealt with that issue of roots not puncturing, but people worried about that question?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, we're not planting trees on our landfill caps. That's generally, no trees on dams. And no trees on landfill caps is kind of a general rule of thumb, and that hasn't changed much. The vegetation on our landfill, that 240-acre landfill that we closed out as phase two, it was pretty much all just, you know, pretty typical seed mixtures.
Okay. Craig, can I just get you to hold off on what you're going to say, and because we just got a whole bunch of new questions, so I want to try to get to those if that's
sure.
All right.
Okay. Of course.
All right, let's see. Here's a question. Was there a human health risk in the past in this area, and was that why there was no local access to the lake and the river and the surrounding land?
I can handle that. There was a pre-existing, pre-spill, there was a fish advisory on this water body because of legacy issues at DOE Oak Ridge. It was primarily because of cesium-137, mercury, and PCBs. The other health risk that we were acutely concerned about as a result of the spill was the dust. Fly ash is roughly 50% fine silica dioxide, which is sand, fine sand. And you know, if not controlled by dust suppression, vegetation, et cetera, that dust can cause respiratory problems. We had perimeter air monitoring. We had a lot of systems in place, engineering systems, as well as human health monitoring to make sure that our dust was not leaving our work area. And first and foremost, you know, we talk all about community, and that's important, but I can tell you our first and foremost concern was the very people that we were working with. You know, we had hundreds of people actually on site working on, you know, day-to-day, you know, track excavator operators, dump truck operators, people loading rail cars, people that were standing on ash, working with ash, you know, 8 hours a day, if not longer. So those folks that were the highest at risk for breathing were outfitted with respirator filters to make sure we knew what they were breathing day, you know, day in, day out on a silica dust standard.
Okay, and there's actually a follow-up to that question, which is that does ecological evaluation indicate that conditions have returned to baseline or returned to, I don't know what you call normal, but I'm sure things are improved?
Yeah, I can handle that. So the phase three study was designed, it's kind of backwards the way most of these Superfund remedies work or these evaluations work. We had done the excavation. We had already removed 3.5 million cubic yards from the river system. So, and we deliberately left about 500,000 cubic yards because it was commingled with legacy constituents from DOE that may have been a bigger problem. Okay, so off we went in the CERCLA 8-step process for ecological risk. And as we went through that, we did a bunch of, we used the Army Corps of Engineers, ERDC Research Center down there in Vicksburg. We did some, you know, two-dimensional modeling for sediment transport, et cetera, et cetera. And what we determined, we had really I think there was about 20 different measurement endpoints that actually went to the blender for analysis for metals-related contaminants associated with coal ash. And what we found was some slight toxicity in the laboratory. We're not the first ecological study in the United States to show slight toxicology in the laboratory, but once we went out to those positions and those same stations in the reservoir, the bugs were there in abundance, and the bugs were there in diversity. So we predicted, we had, you know, through the eco-risk process, we had a protective range for arsenic sediment. We had a protective range for selenium and sediment, as well as tissue monitoring endpoints for a variety of species, including tree swallows. Well, our sediment transport modeling predicted that we would be back to baseline conditions in about a 10 to 15 year time frame. 5 years after the spill, and we're working on, I guess we're coming up on, you know, 10 years after the spill, close, not quite yet, but we have the modeling and, the monitoring data that we have does show that we basically have returned to pre-spill conditions. We were very fortunate that the spill was unfortunate, don't get me wrong, but we were very fortunate that where the spill happened where it did, because this river body had been extensively studied by Oak Ridge scientists, and TVA has a program for all of their reservoirs that they are stewards for. It's called the Bioscience Program. And so we had pre-spill data. So we kind of knew what we needed to get back to. We had fish health, we had bugs counts, we were very fortunate to have not only experienced scientists from DOE that we employed, they did a lot of our eco work for us, but we also knew what the end game was, because we had already established what the baseline was in 06, 07, 08. So we got lucky on that one.
Okay. I think, you know, we have about 10 minutes left. I want to make the most of our time. So I think while I go over the last two questions and wrap it up a little, we'll just put the survey on the screen. And if we could ask you all to fill it out while we go over the last few questions, that would be great. So one of the questions is, I seem to remember that Superfund sites were originally defined as places that could never be reused by people. So when and how did that change? Why don't I give my take on that and see if anybody wants to add. So I not only work in the Superfund program, but I'm the national manager for Superfund reuse. And I can tell you that officially the agency started thinking quite differently in 1999. So that was kind of when we kicked off our Superfund redevelopment initiative. But what we found is that there had been some reuse going on of Superfund sites, but that EPA could play a very important role. And I could obviously talk about this all day, but maybe the important thing to remember is that we now have somewhere around 850 sites that are in some kind of reuse. And they're not only ecological reuse. We have green space, we have businesses, we have solar, we have other alternative energy. We have an animal shelter reuse. I like to say that we haven't come to the end of the list of things that possible types of reuses. So having a Superfund site, you could say, is the beginning of the story and not the end of the story. So does anybody want to add anything to that, Craig or Michelle?
Yeah, I think that points right on. I've been here long enough to see kind of the pre and post, and the pre-thinking for reuse of the Superfund site was right on what the questioner asked. I mean, I, in the early 90s, cleaned up many of sites, put up a big chain link fence, maybe for added measure, some razor wire at the top, you know, and said, stay out. Was there really any reason to stay out? Not if you clean it up right. So, yeah, you know, points right on is that clearly over the last decade it's been, as you're cleaning up these sites, get your head up a little bit, look down the horizon, start talking to your city officials, your county officials, folks that own the property, and say, what's the zoning? What's the current zoning? What's the vision for this property? And, you know, we're not going to pay extra. You know, but if we're not going to pay extra, if we're going to clean up the industrial standards, we're not going to pay extra for residential just because somebody wants it residential, if we're doing the ARRs or for industrial. But there are things, as Michelle mentioned earlier, is why you have the yellow equipment out there. And if you want the sedimentation basin away from the riverfront, because the riverfront we're going to put a boat dock at, a Ferris wheel or whatever it might be, then, yeah. Just let us know where you want the stormwater detention basin. You know, putting in stormwater infrastructure as you clean up a site is pretty standard. If you know what the future land use is going to be, there's usually some economies of scale where you can kind of kill two birds with one stone, right? Your dad always said, do it right the first time. So if you know what that expected future use is, you can do it once, do it right, do it cost-effective, and turn that thing over into a better shape. That's exactly what TVA did with the recreation area. The 60 acres they turned over for the rec fields, TVA put enough. They weren't going to actually build the ball diamonds. They weren't going to build the concession stands. They weren't going to put out the bases and chalk the fields. But, hey, if y'all want a flat space and some parking areas and you want it to drain properly, sure, TVA said, we can do that. And do you think the Roane County Recreation Department was elated? Yeah, they were, you know, because they didn't have those ball fields. They didn't have those walking trails. They didn't have that fish habitat structure before. So it's one of those things that you know, as a project manager at EPA, I'm guilty of this, is that your nose is the grindstone, you're worried about cleaning this project up, and I'm guilty of many, you get tunnel vision about just getting this project cleaned up, moving on to the next. But if you just pick your head up a little bit, look on down the horizon, talk to some folks, do the planning as far as what the anticipated future use is, there's a lot of cost savings that can be realized.
That is great. I think we have time for maybe one more question. We still have a few more slides, but Craig, I think this one's for you. How do NRD trustees, well, you just talked about this, how do NRD trustees value recreational improvements as compensation for natural resource damages? Oh, Gene's answering that.
Michelle might be better to answer that. I'll take a stab at it. Michelle might want to add, is that, of course, the trustees, they're kind of like the Lorax, right? They speak for the Bucks and the Bronnies. I don't think they really care about, I can't speak for them, but I don't know if they really care about little Susie, soccer Susie, or little baseball playing Johnny. But I've done some restoration work up at 12 Mile Creek in South Carolina, where we took down several dams associated with the PCB site, and while we did benefit, to return some river to free-flowing conditions, as a kind of side bonus, we created Class 2 whitewater that the whitewater enthusiasts just think is pretty darn good. So they're willing to consider it, but, I mean, Michelle might be in a better position to talk about it. Michelle and gang went through all the HEA analysis and all that stuff, right, Michelle?
Right, so they're the recreational enhancements that made difference to the NRDA trustees were the ones that provided access to the water. During our operation and our cleanup, we had to close the entire river for a portion of that time for safety reasons because we had large dredges out there, and so we couldn't allow people to access the river. So the losses that the trustees considered were the fact that people couldn't boat or fish on the river for some time, and to make up for those losses to the users of the river, the boat ramps and the fishing piers and the canoe launches were things that the trustees were interested in to offset that loss.
Okay. I hate to cut us off, but we do have a little bit more. I do want to thank all panelists. I've really enjoyed hearing and learning more about ecological revitalization, and the example I think really makes you think about what we can all think about at our site. We found that sharing these stories of successful reuse projects is one of the most effective tools for promoting safe and beneficial reuse. And these stories allow us to demonstrate how tools and resources can be used effectively, and I hope provide inspiration for those of you who are looking to reuse contaminated properties. So our presenters have done this today by sharing their stories. Again, thank you. I just want to spend a minute on some resources, and then we'll see how we're doing with some more questions. So, okay, great. I just want to remind you that we have a number of tools and resources on our website whenever you are thinking of any type of reuse, and you can take a look at a lot of project examples and get more information about the reuse planning process. We have fact sheets, we have technical reports, and if you're considering a certain type of reuse, I want to encourage you to check out our redevelopment partnership webpage to see which organizations might be able to help. And again, the SRI website is included as a link in the additional resources on the right side of your Adobe Connect screen. And also, SRI has a redevelopment coordinator in each region to support reuse at the site-specific level. So if you'd like more information about an existing reuse project, or you'd like to discuss exploring ecological revitalization or other reuse opportunities for a site near you, please feel free to get in touch with your regional coordinator. Okay. If you have any general questions about the material covered in the webinar, or you'd like more information about SRI, don't hesitate to contact me or Frank Avisado. If you haven't answered the survey questions, I'd like to encourage you to do that. And because we base these webinars on your feedback and what you'd like to see next. So with that, I think we're pretty much okay. I'm going to turn it back to Jean, and I think we're going to end right on time. So Jean?
Oh, well, thank you very much. I'll spend the last minute just reminding everyone that you can access the previously recorded SRI webinars on the CLUIN SRI website. You can also browse the other archives that we have available up on CLUIN. Again, we have well over 600 of those sessions available for on-demand playback. I want to thank the well over 200 individuals who joined us from all over the country for today's live broadcast. If you'd like to learn about upcoming sessions or seminars, you're certainly welcome to follow us on popular social and professional networking sites or sign up for one of our free monthly newsletters on Clue In. Just a quick reminder, today's session was recorded. You will automatically receive an email when the recording is available. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to produce that. Feel free to forward that email on to anyone else you think will find this a valuable use of their time. We do have the online feedback form up and available. I shared that link right in the questions box. As Melissa noted, we do read each and every submission. Please take a moment and fill out that form. A few of you have asked if you can earn certificates for or credit for CEUs or PBHs for participating today. If you fill out the online feedback form, there is a box you can check on that form near the top to request a confirmation email to be sent to you for your records. We don't issue CEUs or PBHs for these sessions. However, many participants are still able to earn credit with their accrediting institutions by keeping copies of their registration emails, copies of the materials which are available on the seminar resources page, and then filling out feedback and saving that confirmation email, which will show a date and time when you shared feedback. If you happen to be watching the recorded version of today's session, you can still follow those same instructions and share feedback for the recorded session and try to earn credit for replaying today's broadcast. Again, thank you so very much for joining us for today's live session. This will be the formal conclusion for today's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinar. Have a great day.